genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ AM 1400. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is language. My first guest was Police Chief Ken Corney of Ventura, and he warned us of the pitfalls in the language of Proposition 19, the Regulate, Control, and Tax Cannabis Act that's on the ballot November the 2nd. My next guest is the foremost authority on Noel Coward. And Noel Coward was synonymous with the English language, wit, and charm in the 20th century. Singer Eddie Cantor described Noel Coward as the George M. Cohan of Britain. But I think that sells Noel Coward short, because Noel Coward's career spanned four decades. His writing and music defined an era in Great Britain. He was considered the embodiment of British wit and culture here in the United States. And my next guest captures all of that in his book titled The Noel Coward Reader. If you want to join us, you can join the conversation by calling us at 639-0008. Barry Day was born in England. He has his master's from Balliol College in Oxford. He has written or edited some 20 books, as well as plays and musical reviews, showcasing the works of such artists as Dorothy Parker, P.G. Woodhouse, Oscar Wilde, and Sherlock Holmes. He's written 8 books on Noel Coward, and he's a trustee of the Noel Coward Foundation. He was awarded the Order of British Empire, OBE, for his service to British culture here in the United States. Welcome to the show, Barry Day. How are you today?
Well, not too bad, although it's pouring with rain down in sunny Florida.
Oh, well, so much for sunny Florida, but at least you're there in sunny Florida, and that's a wonderful place to be in the wintertime. So,
not too bad.
Yeah, not bad at all. So, Barry, as I said at the outset, you're probably one of the foremost authorities on Noel Coward, and he was an English playwright, he was a composer, he was a director, an actor, a singer, he was known for his wit, he was known for his flamboyance, and even Time magazine called him, he had a sense of personal style, a combination of what they called cheek and chic, pose and poise. And I admit, my knowledge of Noel Coward is somewhat limited. So what makes Noel Coward so appealing to you as a writer and a historian?
Well, it's partly that he has such considerable range. I mean, he was a playwright, wrote verse, he wrote sketches, he wrote songs and the music to go with them. The combination, somebody once said of him, there may be better comedians, better tragedians, better writers, better film actors, but if there are, there are 14 different people, because only one man had all 14 different skills, the master, Noel Coward. And that was said by his friend, Lord Louis Mountbatten, on the eve of his 70th birthday. And I think that pretty well sums it up. He was multi-talented, and I would defy you or anybody else to name anybody who had that range and the quality within that range.
Absolutely. I mean, it is amazing. Just for listeners who might not know about Noel Coward, give us some idea of some of his famous plays, some of his famous music, and things that he did that would make him noteworthy.
For instance, the plays that are revived the most often, and they're revived more now than even when he was alive, are things like Private Lives, A Fever, Present Laughter. Those three are done time and time again. The Vortex, his very first successful play, is often revived. And the songs, of course, are the things that really linger for more people, and not because they sum up a particular moment in time, like London Pride, Don't Let's Be Beasts of the Germans, which caught the atmosphere of World War II.
Right.
And then the love songs. I mean, the man was not only a funny, witty man, he was also a very sentimental and loving man. I mean, I'll see you again, somewhere I'll find you, I'll follow my secret heart. So the man covered a range of human emotions, and it's very hard not to respond to somebody who expresses what you have felt, but you weren't sure who else had. But he tells you that he has in such a way that you kind of say, yeah, that's right, you know.
We're talking to Barry Day, everybody. You can hear in his voice the sentiment that he has for Noel Coward and the man's wonderful career. So tell us the story of Noel Coward. I mean, he started in acting in the 1910s. He was probably most prolific in the 30s during the Great Depression, and he was one of the world's highest earning writers at that time, and he worked all the way through the 60s. Tell us a little bit about his career.
Well, he was a child actor. He first began to act and also to write when he was about six. He had a stage mother, which led him, I think, to write, "Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington." He knew that from the inside. Then he began to write plays as well. And in his late teens and early 20s, he was a playwright, writer, author. His first play was about 1920. And then at one point, he had about five plays running simultaneously on the London stage. Came to the States in 1921 for the first time with absolutely no money, not even enough to get back home. Became friends with Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne, who were living together in some proximity, but they weren't yet the Lunts. And those three became friends for the rest of his life, 50 years. So he then began to alternate between London and New York from the 20s onwards, and mostly in plays, occasionally in films. He made a film in America in 35 called The Scoundrel, and thought he might make more films, but it took rather too much time. So he then didn't do any more until 42, when he did the film that many people remember him for, In Which We Serve, during World War II.
Yes.
And that really did break a lot of boundaries for him, and had to deal with government people and so on. He was a spy during the war. He was recruited in 1938 by the Foreign Office to simply go around being Noel Coward, but taking impressions from the people that he met in the course of that, as to what opinion was in Europe, because there were people in England who felt we should rearm, that there's going to be a war. The government was obsessively determined not to see that, but the ones who felt clearly about it included Coward. So that was never really explained or expressed until very late in his life, because he was sort of covered by the Official Secrets Act. But in 1973, just before he died, he did a television interview where he talked about those days. And said, I thought it might be more like Mata Hari. And then I thought, well, it couldn't be really, because I could never wear a jewel in my navel, as I believe she was given to doing. So that was his wartime thing. And then Brief Encounter, the movie, which now can be seen in a stage version in New York, which kept the feeling of the movie, ranked by many people to be the most romantic film ever made, even though the two people never make love. That's very British for you. After the war, he was somewhat dropped in England because austerity Britain, how could somebody who wrote about duchesses and people who had nothing to do for a living possibly understand the post-war world of austerity? But the American public never lost faith in him, and he was very, very loyal and grateful to them, and much of his later work in the 60s was written for the Broadway stage, like Sail Away and Girl Who Came to Supper. So he was a man of two continents, more really, because he traveled widely. And people respected that because what he says is universal. And new audiences now are finding that instead of this man being a boring old man that was so relevant to maybe their grandfathers, he's talking to me, they say. We get this all the time, and it's very, very encouraging.
We're talking about Noel Coward, and we're talking to one of the world's leading authorities on Noel Coward. His name is Barry Day. And Barry, one of the things you alluded to in your brief overview of his history, his career, was that he wrote a lot about high society. It was always sort of the backdrop for his plays. Why do you think he chose to set his plays in high society?
Well, I think he was a social snob, among other things, like many people. I think he aspired to knowing those people. Of course, in the end, he did. And as you go through his letters, which I put together a couple of 3 years ago, he knew everybody. He knew the landed gentry. He knew the theatrical community. He knew firemen. He knew dustmen. He really just was interested in people. And if you think about on British theatre history, it's quite a common thing from Shakespeare through the Restoration to take the upper classes as being a kind of a model also for satire. You can make fun of them safely because you aren't one of them yourself as the audience. But it's human nature in general, and they are no different from you and I. So in any case, his use of language, I think, was very key. And I think a lot of Americans find it quite hard to understand exactly why, because in English English, as opposed to American English, you tend to say the opposite of what you really mean. So he would use language, say, in private lives as a defense against emotion. If you remember scene between the two of them, Amanda and Elliot on the balcony, they talk about going around the world and very flat Norfolk, and they're not talking about that, they're talking about each other. But they can't bring themselves to begin with to actually say, and how are you, and I still love you, and you still love me. So they have to wrap it up. And that use of language is very distinctive, and it comes better in a way, because if you use upper-class people, they've, in theory, got a much better vocabulary and can use words like that credibly. But he uses their use of it for other purposes. He's giving you his meaning through their words. The words are sort of a strategy for defense.
Ah, well said, well said. We're talking to Barry Day, everybody. And Barry, something that we do on the show is a thing that I call the quick fire. Now, I'm going to give you the names of some plays or some music, and I want your top-of-mind thoughts about the item that I throw before you. And the first has to be The Vortex, the beginning play, probably his first most famous play, Noel Coward.
All right.
Thoughts on that? What is the Vortex?
Well, he wrote this play and presented it to the Lord Chamberlain's office, which was the official censor in Britain, and they wanted to turn it down. But then the top man, the Lord Chamberlain, said to one of his people, if we ban this, we shall have to ban Hamlet, because the key scene in the play, the key emotional scene, is the drug addict son talking to his adulterous mother, very much like Hamlet talks to Gertrude. So when they went to make a film of that, the people in the studio send their young man around with a script to the film studios, and the man came back and said, oh, good news. They've approved it entirely. Just two small things. Your son can't take drugs, and the mother can't have affairs. So the director said, oh, I see, fine. So what we're going to be left with is, Mummy, if you give up teas and dances, I'll give up cigarettes and aspirin. But they made the film anyway, and it did okay.
Well, now, interesting that you should focus in on that, because wasn't the drug use on the part of the son just a thinly veiled covenant, a front for homosexuality?
Many people have said that, yes, it could easily be. Homosexuality in England at that time was illegal. So was drug addiction, of course, come to that. But it might have been. There's no evidence that he ever said that to anybody about anything. But, yeah, I mean, if you want to read that into it, this is the essence of good theatre and good fiction, surely, that I will say something. If you can see more in it that's meaningful to you, that's your version of that book or that play. And I think it's quite possible, yeah.
Very...
He never overtly talked about homosexuality, although he was, as we all know, gay, until pretty well his last play, Song of Twilight, when the leading character is a combination of Max Beerbohm and Somerset Maugham, with his ex-mistress coming along, about to publish a memoir which reveals that the man himself was, in fact, gay as well. That was very late in life, like 1966, and he could say it then. But I always object to young directors who come to the more established plays of characters, like Private Lives, A Fever, Design for Living, which is revived in London right now. And they say, oh, well, you see, if Darling Noel could have written the way he wanted to write it, he would have done this. And this drives me up the wall, because there's no evidence that he would. He always said that implication is more satisfactory than explanation. And I think that's a literary device in itself, really. You let people become part of your show.
Absolutely. We're talking to Barry Day, everybody. I'm going to throw another one at you, and you mentioned this in your explanation about The Vortex, and that is Hay Fever. What do you think of Hay Fever?
Hay Fever has lasted very well, considering he himself thought it was really quite slight and didn't have any real bon mot in it. In his career, when he started, he was trying to be like Oscar Wilde and have every line, a sharpened quill, as it were. And when he did this, he was getting to the point of understanding it was language, behavior, relationships that were really funny, and that a line like, this haddock's disgusting, is hilarious in context. It was based upon the American actress Laurette Taylor, who had an apartment in New York and entertained a great deal, and she and her family were as divorced from reality as the Bliss family are in this. They invite these guests down for the weekend, totally ignore them, the guests steal away, and the family don't even notice until they've gone. So it was really just a very light little farce about relationships and the embarrassment of social relationships. But it struck that chord to me. We've all been to those sort of parties where you think, oh, my God, when can I get out of here, you know?
All right, we're talking to Barry Day, everybody. I'm going to switch from plays to music now, and the song that I'm thinking of is Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Mad Dogs and Englishmen. He wrote that in a car ride between Hanoi and Saigon in 1930, and he was driving through the jungle. He said he was struggling with rhymes and scansion because he had no paper with him and no pen, and so he had to memorize it all, and it took about, it was about a 24-hour ride altogether. And when he got to the jungle guest house, he said, I wrote it down quickly. He said, and then I sang it to my traveling companion in this jungle guest house where only other people, only other things were the gecko lizards and the tree frogs, who appeared to like it very much indeed, he said. But the other part of the story on that, which is in the early years of the war, Churchill and Roosevelt got to know each other well, but they didn't always know each other well. And when they were on HMS Prince of Wales to sign the Atlantic Charter, they had a perfectly good meeting and then went off to have a private meeting. And their aides were very concerned that there was what they considered to be a heated altercation. And they thought, oh my God, you know, the alliance is foundering even now. And what it was about was an argument between Churchill and Roosevelt as to what was the order of the verses in Mad Dogs and Englishmen. And later on, Churchill said to Coward back in England, he said, you better adjudicate. And Coward said, well, Prime Minister, I'm afraid I have to tell you that you were wrong and the President was right. And Churchill fixed him with that bulldog stare and said, Britain can take it.
All right, another very famous Noel Coward song is London Pride. Your thoughts on that?
That is a song that makes Englishmen of my generation feel very choked up when we hear it, because we remember the context and the times when England was alone. He was standing in a London terminal station one morning after a particularly heavy raid, and there was debris all around and smoke in the air, and he said, I watched my fellow Londoners going about their business as if nothing out of the way had occurred, and I felt so proud of them and so moved by it. He said, and then I noticed a little flower growing in a crevice. He said, and I remember the name for it. It has a Latin name, but we all called it London Pride. And he said, and then I thought of a piece of music. There had been an old Violet Sellers, Lavender Sellers street cry in London many, many years before, which the Germans had then taken away and turned into Deutschland über alles. He said, I thought it was time we had it back. So we took that back, and the essence of the song, the tune itself, is exactly that if you think about it.
I see. We're talking to Barry Day, everybody, one of the world's leading authorities on Noel Coward. And Barry, Noel Coward hoped that his epitaph would be, he was much loved because he made people laugh and cry. Why is that a fitting remembrance of the man?
Well, because he did have the ability, it was admitted he had a talent to amuse, and was inclined to let you think that that's really all he had, but of course that was tongue-in-cheek, and you were meant to say, as everybody did, yeah, there's more than that. He had a feeling for people, the way they felt. He could amuse them because he was witty. But in a late interview, I think the key to it was given then. He was very old by this time, would die within a few months. And the interviewer said to him, could you sum up your life, the whole thing of your life, in one word? And he thought, uncharacteristically, it didn't come to him immediately, or he was considering it, and he said, now comes the difficult time when you have to decide whether to be corny or not, but there is one word, and that word is love. He said, to know you're among people you love, who love you, that has made all success that much more wonderful than it would have been anyway. He said, and then he broke down. He said, and that's all there is, really. That's it.
Oh, and what a fitting note to end this interview on. We've been talking to Barry Day, everybody. His latest book is titled The Noel Coward Reader. It is a wonderful book, beautifully printed. If you're looking for somebody who on your Christmas list who enjoys good biographies, this would be a great book to recommend to him. Barry, thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming. We'll talk to you down the road.
Okay, take care.
Take care.